All right, the usual flurry of announcements at the beginning of class. So first of all, just a reminder, homework five, the last homework is due Wednesday, I guess in class, unless I said something different on Canvas. I don't remember what the actual time is that it's due, but to that point, tonight from 5 to 7, if you haven't already seen the announcements somewhere else, there's going to be another Python Hangout job thing. Carrie and Robbie and Ray will all be there. I may make an appearance depending on how things are going in my own personal life. That's, like I said, 5 to 7 right here in this very room. There will again be snacks. And you can work on the homework, whatever questions you want to have about that. They will all be there to help. I think Carrie and Robbie have identified, based on questions they've gotten, a few things that they want to focus on for sure, but of course any questions, you can just sit and work on it, you know, whatever you want to do. This is obviously the last week of class, right? Carrie looks surprised. Today and Wednesday are the last 2 days for this class, and next week is the start of exams. Next week also happens to be the best time to do a class observing night at the telescope, weather permitting. The Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday nights are all currently unscheduled. Do you have a preference as a class to which day we do it?
Wednesday.
So hands for Wednesday is good for most people. Who would prefer Tuesday? Who would prefer Monday? Okay, well, we'll see whether the weather cooperates for any of those days. I'll let you know. Of course, it's December in Cleveland, so I would expect to not do anything at all. That's the default position for telescopes in Cleveland in the winter, is just don't bother. There was one nice night in the last 2 weeks. So, I was going to say something else, but I forgot what it was. Maybe I'll remember at some point. So we're going to talk about this last week. We're going to talk about exoplanets. I sort of want to make this more of a way for us to, as a class, sort of reapproach different topics that we've talked about. Think about things that we've talked about in previous sections. Think, you know, stars, planets, right? There's different topics in there that are going to be relevant to how we know about exoplanets. So I'm going to do a lot more like asking you questions and having you try and piece together an answer, right? So this is sort of half new topic, half review for final exam topics in a lot of ways, right? Thinking about fundamentals, stuff like that. So we will do most of the nitty-gritty stuff today. And then on Wednesday, we can, depending on how much left we have to talk about exoplanets, we can do that, and then we can just have review time too as well. But depending on how far we get today, it will be a fun activity. Notice the use of liberal air quotes, fun activity, that we will do either the end of today or Wednesday. Anyway, so here is the first thing I wanted to show you, right? This is a graph over time of the total number of exoplanets that we know about. So this is current as of last week, right? We know about 4,000 of these jumps of 200, about 4,600 exoplanets. In 1989, the year after I was born, we knew about one. So between 1989 and 2021, last week, we have discovered about 4,600 exoplanets. And so these are color-coded by the different methods that we've used to do those detections, right? So you can sort of see the most popular two methods by far are green, which is transits, and pink, which is radial velocity. And then you have a couple other methods lumped in here, right? You have something called microlensing, imaging, which is like direct, like you took a picture of it and said, oh, hey, that's an exoplanet. And other small things that we're not even going to bother talking about because they account for a handful of exoplanets each. But they're there, they are ways of detecting things. We're also going to kind of ignore microlensing because I don't want to talk about general relativity in the last week of 221. But basically, microlensing is you use gravity as a lens and it makes things look brighter behind. So you can detect that something is there by looking at the lights, how it is changed by the gravity of the thing that it's in front. But it's a way of detecting exoplanets, you'd be really precise. We're going to mostly talk about radial velocity, transits, and direct imaging. But what I wanted to start with was just sort of a discussion of the various trends that you see in this plot, right? What do you notice about the different methods? Remember, this is cumulative, not how many we've discovered each year. So as you go along, right, you're lumping in the previous however many years into that same bar, right? So this is all we know about, you can sort of see the jump is how many new ones are that year for that method, right? That they stack up. So take a couple minutes, talk about the various trends in here, right? What are you seeing the different colors do? If you, really want to think about it, there's a couple pixels on top here of the different colors. But, the main things that you can actually see are there. One question David asked at the beginning, which I wanted to turn back on you as a class, is what happened between 2013 and 2016 that there was such a big jump in exoplanets as a whole? So talk about it for a minute, or two, or three. Has an insight they would like to share? Eric?
I think that the big jump in transit discoveries has something to do with the launch of the Kepler Space Telescope.
The Kepler Space Telescope. What is the Kepler Space Telescope?
It's got
I'll have
really
to push you on the spot.
I'm not sure for sure, but I think it's got really good detectors for like kind of visible type lights. You can tell when the intensity of the star changes.
Right. So obviously transits, right? That's what is happening, the big jump, right? There's big numbers of transit exoplanets. Kepler is going to turn out to be really good at finding transit exoplanets for some very specific reasons, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. So I heard some of the groups over here talking about that sort of, that maybe not specifically about Kepler, but telescopes that look and watch for things, or new technology. I think Steve, your group said something about new technology, right? That's basically what's happening here, is that we're getting way better at doing around that time, and that's where we start to really see a lot more exoplanets. What about there's obviously big jumps in transits, but what about the idea that we mostly started out knowing about things from radial velocity measurements? Did anyone talk about that at all? Right, if you sort of look right until
2007, we didn't really know about many transit exoplanets at all, and there was a big explosion because of Kepler.
What? Let's talk about the radial velocity method. How do we actually use radial velocity?
What do I mean by radial velocity? Let's start with that. Let's redefine that term. What is radial velocity? That's the general principle behind it, right? So we're watching the star to move, right? Remember that things orbit around their center of mass, and so if the center of mass is not quite exactly in the center of the star will essentially wobble around it. What we're looking there at there, right? The data that we're taking to do that observation is the redshift and blueshift of the star, right? The radial velocity is how it's moving along the line of sight that we see towards and away from us. So if we watch, if we see the star sort of wiggling towards and away from us in a small amount, that's wobbling basically, right? You don't see the side-to-side motion, but we see it as it comes towards and away. So here's basically how this works. Right here we have, we're just using Kepler's third law here. That's the basic principle that we're talking about. Things are orbiting around each other. The amount of time that it takes for those two things to go around, right? The period squared is equal to 4 pi squared over g times the sum of the two masses of the two different parts of the system times the distance between them, the semi-major axis of the orbit cubed, right? So here's a sketch of what we're looking at here. You have two orbits, right? You have a big object, small object. So the small object here is the exoplanet. This is more or less the same thing we talked about when we talked about eclipsing binary stars earlier in the semester, right? Things go in front of each other. So you can use, or you can use binary stars just from a radial velocity measurement perspective. Same idea. So if you look at the change in the position or the velocity of a star over time, you can try to measure that there is a planet of some given mass there, right? If you look here, we have a couple graphs of different ways that this could look like based on the shape of the orbit and the sort of the direction that we're looking at that orbit from. Right? If we're looking at it directly edge on, we'd see one thing. If we were looking at sort of tilted a different way, we'd see another thing. So here is sort of roughly a more or less edge on, more or less circular orbit, and that has a nice sine curve, right? You can just sort of see it goes away from you and then comes back and goes towards you, or vice versa. I'm looking at my perspective. Here is a more elongated orbit. You can see it makes deeper dips, slows down, makes a deep dip as it sort of comes around. And here is a very eccentric orbit, 0.9, right? That's sort of comet-like in terms of its shape. That has really sharp spikes where it comes in very quickly, whips around the star, and then goes out and slowly makes its way back before it falls in very quickly again and then goes back out. So that doesn't just tell you about the existence of a planet, it tells you about the shape of its orbit, what kind of planet it might be.
What kind of planet is this going to work best for? Another discussion question for you, right? If we think about the kinds of planets that are going to be easy to see using this method, what kinds of planets? Think about our solar system, right? What kinds of planets are going to be the ones that we're going to be most likely to detect using the radial velocity method, and thinking about Kepler's third law and second law, I guess, too. Talk about it for a minute. Think of this as time, basically. This is just, if you take,
divide by the period, right? That's 0 to 1 full period. So you just kind of stack.
Well, I guess
so is the radial velocity the velocity of the entire system, or
and
the
then
star?
That's you observe how fast the star is moving.
The star.
So you're measuring the velocity of this.
The star as the planet.
Star.
But the orbital phase is up. Because
you can't directly see the planet.
Yeah.
So you're looking at the star is moving.
And that's if it, we're like looking at it directly and it's going like this.
Yeah.
So what if it's going like this?
It is going like that. We just can't measure
okay.
that motion. It's making an ellipse, right?
Okay.
So if you imagine, like, so we're looking at the system from top down here, right? What you're looking at is from over here in the plane of the screen. You're looking at the orbit from over here and seeing how it moves along. On the orbit, where it's moving towards Berlin. Does that make sense? So what kind of planet is going to be the best or the easiest to see with this method? Garrett?
Very massive ones.
Very massive ones. Why?
Because it's going to have a greater effect on the, measure.
Basically, right, if you imagine that you have two objects, right, the closer in mass they are to each other, the further away from the center of the star the center of mass will be. Right, so if you can move that center of mass further out of the center of the star, you'll observe more of a wobble, right? What is another characteristic of a planet that would be advantageous for the radial velocity? Other than planet size. Steve?
Semi-major axis.
How far away it is from the star, right? It's going to be a lot easier to notice a rapid change than it is a slow change, right? So if your planet's really close in, you're going to observe more periods in a shorter amount of time. That's going to let you clue you into the fact that something weird is going on more easily, right? If you have a planet that's way out, like out Neptune distance from the star, that's a really slow orbit, right? That takes hundreds of years to happen. That's not going to be observable on a human time scale in a few days. So close, massive planets are really easy to see with this method. Distant planets and small planets, more distant small planets, right? There's different combinations of things there. Those are going to be harder to see. So that's the radial velocity method. Here is the transit method. This is just the basic fundamental thing here. This is an eclipsing binary star. Just instead of a second star, you have a planet that doesn't emit any light of its own. So we're sitting here, we're watching a star over time, right? So here's time along this x-axis. We watch the brightness of this star over time, and then we observe a dip in that for a while, and then it goes back up to its normal brightness. That means that something has gone in front of that star. We don't know what, right? Could be anything. Could be an asteroid in our solar system, something like that. Something blocks out the light of that, some of the light of that star. It looks a little bit dimmer for a while. If it's a planet around that star, what you would see is, right, as the planet is here in its orbit, it's not blocking out any light. As it's crossing the edge of the star, you see a slow decrease in the amount of light that you are observing. And then as the planet crosses that star, it blocks out some of that light. It makes the brightness drop by a given amount, given the size of the planet. And then as it crosses the edge back out, it comes back up. Excuse me. Tickle. It comes back up to its intrinsic brightness. Discussion question. Is one dip in brightness enough tell you that you have detected a planet?
talk about it for a minute. Why or why not? Okay, what do we think? No. Why not, David?
So if you see one tip, like on that that one right there, it that could be something just passing in between you and what you're observing. But if it repeats itself and it has a period, then you know it's something that's actually going to be repeating its orbit.
Right. What you want to look for is a repeating regular dip in brightness. Right, so you're looking for something that's equally spaced, right? You so say you have a planet with a period of 28 days, right? It dips, comes back up, 28 days later it dips, comes back up, 28 days later it dips, comes back up, right? You're looking for a repeated, regular change in the brightness of the star. Once you have that, right, you have a period. You know the mass of the star, you can figure out how far away from the star that planet is. If you can figure out that information, if you can figure out the distance some other way, you can figure out the mass of the star, right? There's different things that you can tell about this. It also tells you the size of the planet, like the radius of the planet, right? Because you're looking at the dip, how long it takes that dip to drop. Beginning to end tells you how wide the planet is relative to the star. That's an interesting thing to know. Similarly to the radial velocity question, what kind of planets are going to be the easiest to detect using this method? Right? What's going to be easier to notice? What's going to be harder to notice? What are other issues involved in having this kind of detection? Right? What conditions do you need? Talk about those things for a few minutes. Okay, what do we think? What kind of planets are going to be easiest to find with this method? Okay.
Planets with a large radius and that are close to the star.
Big planets and close planets again, right? Why, Daniel?
If it's got a larger radius, it'll cause like a bigger dip in the like curve, and if it's closer, it'll have a faster orbit.
So right. So you'll have more repeated. Transits, right? What planets are going to be difficult to detect? Small ones, obviously, right? Because they're not going to produce as big of a dip. Hear it?
Smaller ones have really large periods. The period comes back, it's an asteroid.
Right. If you're looking for Neptune, right, that's not going to happen, right? Because you have to sit and wait for hundreds of years for that to come back around. You might observe one transit, but you're not going to look at the second one. So you might say, oh, maybe there's Neptune there, but we can't be sure. What is another issue involved here, David?
You have to be looking on edge-on.
Right. You have to actually be able to have the planet go in front of the star, which means you have to be basically within 1 or 2 degrees of the plane of that solar system. Otherwise, you're not going to observe that transit. There's actually an interesting problem in the book that you can work through the geometry of that if you want to do with some extracurricular math. Recommend it. So the question then becomes, right, if you have to be edge on, as we say, to observe transits, and solar systems can have any random orientation, right? That's a big correction factor that you have to think about when you're trying to guess how many planets there are out in the solar system, out in the universe, right? Out in the galaxy, at least. If you can only observe 1 in 360 possible solar systems, I guess 1 in 180, because, you know, that's not going to be a particularly big fraction of the total number of stars that are out there, right? So that's a big thing to think about when you're doing your correction. So, here is the big jump, right? Here is the Kepler Space Telescope. Kepler is the satellite here. More or less, think of the Hubble Space Telescope. It's about yay big around. What Kepler did was it sat for, what, 3-4 years, right? And it stared at this patch of sky, which is sort of roughly full moon-ish size, maybe a little bit bigger, for that entire 3 to 4 years, and just watched for the stars. Here is a picture of the full Kepler field of view, right? In the constellation Cygnus, which is the lowercase T-shaped one you see in the summer triangle, just sat there and watched using a very high precision camera for 3 to 4 years, looking for dips in the stars here, dips in brightness. Kepler's camera had the ability to detect changes in brightness on the order of like 10 parts per million, which is really impressive when you're looking for little planets. They were trying to detect Earth-sized planets in the habitable zone. We're talking about what habitable zone is. In the habitable zone, which is basically the ring around a star where you can have liquid water. So Earth is in the habitable zone of the Sun. And it found what, like 3,000 planets? Just in that one little patch of sky? That's pretty impressive, isn't it? That we were able to do that. But what we have to remember, right, is that we sat and we stared at that patch of sky for 3 to 4 years. Waiting. David?
You know how much of the sky that is? That it was like percentage-wise?
There's 44,000, roughly, square degrees in the sky. And the moon is like 2 square degrees. So not much. A very small fraction. So we took a very deep look at this one patch of sky and found 3,000-ish planets. Unfortunately, after a few years, Kepler was, the camera and stuff was still working. One of the gyroscopes, two of the gyroscopes, some number of gyroscopes broke. They only have one left. So they can't stay pointed at that same patch of sky anymore. So now they are sort of going around in a circle, looking at different patches and doing different things for shorter amounts of time, but sort of at a different cadence, right? You're not looking at the same, you're looking at it for 2 months, then you're switching, then you're coming back in a year, right, basically.
So that's not super helpful anymore. We have a new satellite now called TESS, the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite. And it's orbiting around the Earth. It's some weird 2-to-1 resonance with the moon. And it's trying to observe the entire sky. Sort of in that same repeating, we're going to do a patch for a couple days, then we're going to come back in a couple days and sort of do sort of a cadence thing where you're taking a picture and coming back and looking. Here is the the rough map of how this works. The sky is basically divided into squares that it observes. And you can see here, this globe over here shows you how many total days worth of observation that part of the sky gets. So most of the sky only gets like 27 total days of view. Orange gets 54, or light brown, whatever color that is, 54. Dark blue gets 81, green gets 108. And then basically around the pole, there's this red region that gets nearly a full year of observation in the course, over the course of a year, or over the course of the entire mission, which I think was only supposed to last a couple years. But the main mission is over and they're continuing on with full further observations now, but they've discovered, right, they're sort of slowly trickling in now, right? The sort of the rate has gotten a little steeper. It's been up in 2018, right? So now we're starting to add more from tests. We'll start to see big jumps. There's already 1,000 new candidates that haven't been confirmed yet. So that's TESS. What's going to be the main difference between TESS and Kepler, right? If you're thinking about the way we've designed the survey, what are the main differences between the two, right? Talk about that for a minute. That's the continuous part that's confusing me.
This is the official JWST docs.
Yes.
Does this just look at the north hemisphere?
It does both.
It's
the entire sky, plus or minus the little gray caps.
Like for both poles for 361 days?
For both what?
Poles?
Yeah.
How's it look at both poles?
It basically just, if you imagine the satellite just sort of slowly spins around like this. And then it just sort of starts pointing this way, and then slowly it goes pointing here, and it goes around there. And then they turn, and they go up over like that. And they turn, and they go up over like that, and they repeat. And then they switched, and they did the south first, and then the north.
So, David? The amount of time, like in the 27, 4-day this amount of time. That's just total amount of time, right?
That's total amount of time.
Yeah. So when it looks, so like when it comes back to the same place, like after a certain amount of days,
mm-hmm.
it's going to take like a quick measurement, right? So does
right.
that mean that the
so you might
the,
sit and stare for a day
like
or two?
Well, yeah. So it's just going to be like a periodic, like the gravity
yeah.
of force is going
right.
to be like a periodic thing where
right.
it measures it, but
yeah.
it's going to assume that something's in front of it. You're not going to see that. You're not necessarily going to see the transition, but you'll see the differences.
Right.
Okay.
So you'd catch things that lined up with your cadence.
Yeah.
Right. So if you were visiting for 6 hours every 3 days, you'd see things that had, you know, periods that were multiples of three that lined up with that. Right. But as you get closer to the pole, you're visiting that more times, and so you're going to see things that are going to fill in the gaps, basically.
So does that mean that you could theoretically miss a transit?
Yes.
So much, like, time.
Yep. You miss it. You might miss it by an hour, a few
yep.
minutes, even. But it just comes down to the timing.
Right. And so this might be getting into our discussion, but doesn't that also mean that you're not going to see a lot of, like, longer period stars, transits.
Yep. So again, this is targeted mostly for Earth-like things, right? So first, we'll get into that. All that's another good question. Okay. So, first of all, what's the difference basically between Kepler and TESS then, in terms of their main way of doing things, Garrett?
Because of staring up to one spot for a long time, it can see less massive stars that have, or just stars in general that have longer periods because it's staring at the same spot for much longer.
Yeah.
So it would be looking for stars that are, or it could look for stars that are, or see planets that are further, or have a longer period, either further away or they're less massive.
Yeah. Right, so you have a full 4 years of data, unbroken, like curve, for all the stars in that field, right? So you're going to catch anything that has a period less than 4 years, which in our solar system is all the terrestrial planets, right? That's pretty good. That's what we would call depth. Right, you're going to look at everything you possibly can in this one small area. TESS does what we call breadth, where it looks at the entire sky, but not very deep. Right, you only have limited data for each individual patch of sky, so you're not going to get a full complement of data for each individual patch. Now this color-coded globe, right? That's telling you, you know, like there are parts that you get pretty good data, right? You for this patch up here, you're going to do pretty well. What were you saying there at the end, David? I forgot already. Something interesting.
I was just saying that you're going to see a lot more planets with like closer, like with smaller. Shorter periods and like they're going to be closer
right.
and everything. And then as compared to the other one,
right.
I don't really.
Right. I mean, so TESS is going to be roughly biased towards the bigger, closer things, right? Things that are going to be on really
yeah.
short periods that are making big dips that are easy to see. Yeah, Joanne.
Okay, so like how often does it return to the spots that are like 27 or 54?
I don't know. Maybe Ray,
I'm confused because it seems like if it was a further away planet, since it has such a longer orbit, it's more likely that it'll stay within that zone of covering part of the star for
right.
a long enough time that it will come back and see it.
Right.
But like if the planet has a shorter orbit, like less than a year, then it seems like it only covered that part of the star that makes like a difference in the light for a very short period of time. It's likely that it will miss
right.
it. So, like, why isn't it likely to catch those orbits that'll take longer? I mean, other than the fact that they won't decrease the light as much?
I think it's just that you are purposely leaving a view
view of that star for some period of time, and you don't know ahead of time how long the period will be. So if you leave the star, if you say you expect a period of 3 days, right, and you're coming back to that star every 2 days, you need to get a multiple, you have to have a common factor to observe that again. And so you have to come back every 6, 12, right, even number of multiples of 3. So it's going to take you longer to build up repeated transits to confirm that it's there.
Okay.
Because you're leaving and you're not looking at it for a while, and you might miss the second transit in that period you're not looking at it. So you're just missing out things because you're not staring all the time at the same star. That's why it's going to miss things. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I just don't understand why it's less likely to see as long as it can detect the difference in the brightness, why it's less likely to detect those things that will be covering it for a greater amount of time.
I'm not sure I understand the question.
So, if something has a slower orbit, won't it be covering the star for a longer amount
of
time?
Sure, yeah. The geometry is complicated.
Okay.
Right, because the further away you get from your star, right, the more likely it is that you will be a little bit off in terms of your inclination angle too. And so you might, Jupiter and the Earth are off by a couple degrees in their orbit. If Jupiter went in front, the Earth wouldn't necessarily. And so you might miss it that way.
Okay.
But yeah, if Jupiter went in front, it's going slower, so you would see it. It would last longer. But it's just a question of those are the easier things to observe. Right? The bigger things, bigger, slower things are going to be, that's going to show up well, but it's confirming if that's the real question.
Okay.
Because you need to get a second one.
Okay.
And if they're far enough out that they're moving really slowly, you have to wait a long time for it to come back. David?
So you said that this is looking for more Earth-like planets, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know how long the 27, 54, all those days are out of the year?
I think this is probably over the course of the entire mission, which was 2 years.
Oh.
Okay. So.
Of primary, we're going to definitely do it for 2 years.
So
they're gonna, now they can repeat.
Are the planets that are within that habitable zone, do they tend to have a period of less than 2 years? Because that's the only way that we would be able to.
Yeah.
Okay. I thought it was 1 year in that.
We'll talk more about habitable zone tomorrow, right? We're gonna kind of do an exercise about life in the universe, right? So this is the fun activity, right? So we'll dig into the definitions and talk about what it means to be in the habitable zone. But basically, if you want to think about it a little bit now, the cooler your star, the closer in you get for your habitable zone. And so thinking about period doesn't necessarily make sense as defining limits for the habitable zone, because a fainter, cooler star, you can be really close and have a short period and still be in it. So for our solar system, it's going to be between 0.7 months and 15 months period, because that's where it is for our sun, right? It's sort of Earth plus or minus. So let's quickly also talk about direct imaging. Right, so this is the easiest way to confirm that something is really there, is to take a picture of it, right? This is how you might do that. So if you can imagine, right, you have a planet orbiting a star, it's a big planet, it's gonna reflect a lot of light or be big enough that it, Jupiter gives off a good amount of infrared light on its own. Some way that you might be able to take an image of that planet. So here are some examples, right? Here's a planet around this star, right? Here's a little faint dot there. Here's another one here. If you zoom in, right, there's that dot right there, which is this planet. You can see some around this planet here. There's one right there. And then the star has been masked out in this picture, but there's also planets here. So, again, for the third time, what kind of planets are going to be the easiest to see with this method?
Absolutely.
They're going to have to be big, right? Because you need to be big enough to reflect a lot of light and or give off lots of light of your own in the infrared. Would you expect to be able to better observe planets close to the star or far away from the star? Ones close to the star will be better lit, that's for sure. Okay. Garrett, I think you were in had your hand up first.
But maybe if it's too close, then it's covered by the much, much brighter star, then you won't be able to see the planet within the star.
Right. I mean, if you look at some of these pictures, right, if you look at where the star is supposed to be, there's like big blacked out mass parts. So if planets were supposed to be right in close to the star, you're not going to notice that in the light of the star itself. The star is too bright compared to the planet to see. So it's actually going to be way easier to look at things that are way far out and aren't moving very fast, because they're going to be easier to notice in the same place over time or close to the same place over time. So that's what this one's doing here, right? They sort of, they're not in here, but in 2012 it was here, but they also saw it here in 2010. Here in 2006, here in 2004, right? So that's, you're finding an orbit for that planet by directly imaging it. So this is going to work best for planets that are way, way, way far out. Like these are your like giant Neptunes, basically, that are far out and reflect a lot of light, or be hot enough on their own that they can show up in an infrared image. So that's direct imaging. Okay, so here now is a graph of the different kinds of exoplanets, right? So they're not color-coded again by the different methods that they were detected with, right? So pink is radial velocity, again, green is transits. Stars are direct imaging. That's sort of another pinkish color. You notice direct imaging, right? They're all really massive things. So mass is the x-axis, period is the mass is the y-axis, period is the x-axis. All the direct imaging ones are really massive things. 10,000, 100,000, a million days. Those are really long periods, right? That's, if you can imagine the solar system, right? Pluto has a period of like 200 days. So not days, sorry,
years.
Not 200 years. Thank you. So, you know, they're way out there. So we have, I put some dashed lines on here to sort of divide this into different categories. So if we're looking at mass, small things, less small, not massive things, that's going to be like the Earth, right? We call those terrestrial planets. So that's what we're looking for, right? That's what we're really interested in finding, right, is more Earths. That's down there at the bottom. It can be any period. Above terrestrial planets, we have super Earths and mini Neptunes, which are just ways of saying these are bigger than Earth and smaller than Neptune. But we don't necessarily know based on their size whether they are really big rocky planets or really small ice giant planets. Right? They could have a big layer of ice on the top or some gaseous atmosphere or just be rocky planets. We're not sure. It's hard to tell. Then we have ice giants above those, so that's just things like Neptune and Uranus. And then on top of that, things that are basically bigger than 40% the size of Jupiter or bigger, those are gas giants, like Jupiter or Saturn, for example. And then over there on the left-hand side of the plot, in that sort of corner there, we have something called hot Jupiters. What on Earth is a hot Jupiter? David?
Something the size of about Jupiter, but orbits very close to a star.
Yeah, so if you look at what we're looking at here, right, we're looking at mass. So these are Jupiter-sized things. Okay, here's Jupiter. This is actually Jupiter, the red dot. And here is Earth down here.
These are Jupiter-sized things that have periods of less than 10 days. Remember that Mercury has a period of 88 days. So these are like basically touching the star. They are literally hot Jupiters. They are just, they're there, they're really hot. They shouldn't be there, basically. But look how many of them we know about. Does that make sense to you? That's a rhetorical question for now, David, unless you have a question. You'll also notice that if you look up, right, look at the where all the radial velocity detected planets are, right, the pink stuff, that's mostly gas giants. And it's mostly things that are a few years in terms of their period. There are barely any transit detected planets out here. There's maybe one, a couple, right? There's a handful. It's a very small amount. Those are going to be things that are like, oh, they just found the second one before Kepler died, basically. There's sort of a weird valley here for the ice giants. There's not a lot going on there. There's some stuff, but it's kind of, you can sort of see there's what we would call a bimodal distribution, where there's lots of stuff up here, not much here, and then lots of stuff here. So we know about a lot of mini Neptunes and super Earths. And then as far as terrestrial planets go, a handful again. We don't know about very many. There are some in there. We know about a couple that are really small compared to a thousandth of Jupiter's mass. That's really tiny, like moon, kind of moon size. So think back to the different methods we've talked about, right? The way, the kinds of planets that you can see, the way that we have to do those observations. How can we explain this distribution? Right? How do you account for the fact, sort of looks at what, like the most common kind of planet we know about is a hot Jupiter, which shouldn't really exist the way that it does? Why do we see a lot more mini Neptunes and super Earths than we do regular terrestrial planets? Talk about it for a few minutes. Can we try and explain some of the patterns that we see in this graph? Sort of see that here, right? Super Earth can kind of get up to 10 Earth masses or so. So that's pretty big in terms of mass, right? There's not really anything saying that it can't.
We just see the gas ones.
What will happen is that as they get bigger, they're going to be more and more likely to hold out to gas.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah,
they become a gas giant.
The threshold of Jupiter is like 10 times the Earth's mass.
Yeah.
So if it takes away its atmosphere, it's a super Earth.
Okay,
right.
But underneath all the gas.
Yeah, but it has a ton of gas.
Right, all the gas giants have a rocky planet in the middle.
Okay.
They're just wearing a shirt.
Okay.
Or several shirts. A big puffy jacket.
So this means that there has to be life out there, right? Because so what we're seeing is like hot Jupiters, which is something that it should be very uncommon from what we can understand. But we're seeing a ton of them.
Uh-huh.
And so like if we saw every other planet as much as we saw like the hot Jupiters, like this entire like this would be filled out like so much more, and just the probability of there not being anything else is just like, because there's lots of factors that you need, but, sorry, okay, I just thought that's crazy.
You're preempting tomorrow a little bit. So talk about it, right? What's going on here? Why do we see so many things that shouldn't be there versus things that we know should be there but are harder to see? What's going on here, Joanne?
We said because the hot Jupiters, it's because it's from their transits, and since they're so close and so big, it's going to be really easy to see those from the transits. And then the radial thing, those are further away, but they're still really big, so they're going to make the star.
Right. Exactly, right? If you think about what's going on up here in the gas giant category, these are massive planets. These gas giants are going to have a big effect on their star's velocity. And so, yeah, we're going to see a lot of them out here because they're going to have a you know, those are Jupiter-sized things, things that are bigger than Jupiter, right? Sort of the median distribution here is two Jupiter mass. That's pretty big for a planet. So these are going to be easy to see because they have a big effect on their star, no matter where they are in their orbit. And then hot Jupiters, they have periods of 10 days or less, and they're giant planets. So those are going to be really easy transits to see in transit data, right? And you're going to have, if they have a period of less than 10 days, and you look for 4 years, there's going to be hundreds of them. Hundreds of transits over and over again. Maybe not hundreds, dozens of transits. Maybe hundreds if it's a 2 day, I don't know. Anyway, those are really easy things to see, right? That's the low hanging fruit here, right? You're gonna find all the easy stuff really, really easily, right? It's just gonna fall out. Terrestrial planets like the Earth, those are small, right? If you imagine that our solar system, right, if there's an Earth dot on there for where our Earth would be on this plot, you might notice that there are no exoplanets that we have found that have the same properties as the Earth in terms of mass and period. We can't do it yet. Can't find things that have a period of 365.25 days that are that size at that distance from their star. It's just not possible. We can find things that are a lot closer to their star, right? This stuff, but that's, you know, 10 days around our star. Is that planet going to be habitable? Not even remotely close to habitable, right? Mercury is at 88 days. And it doesn't have an atmosphere. The daytime temperature is thousands of Kelvin. Not gonna happen, right? Do you have a question, David, or someone? Yeah.
Yeah, I do have a question. So I noticed that there's kind of like a bit of a dry spot, like going vertically up from Earth in this chart.
Yeah.
Does that have to do with the fact that we are in a 365-day orbit around our sun? So if something was in like that same kind of time frame, we'd be less likely to spot it?
I don't think so.
Okay. Just a coincidence.
We know how to account, because so if you look at the radial velocity measurements, for example, we know how to account for Earth's motion, and that's easy to do.
Yeah.
So that, I don't think that would contribute really. So basically, what you should really imagine, right, is that we should be seeing, right, is that these should be rare, but we see a lot of them because they're easy to find.
Yeah.
So really, if you could correct this for how many things there really are, this sort of band here would have two giant clouds of planets in it, right? There'd be a ton of gas giants, a ton of things in this area, sort of. Super Earth, mini Neptune, terrestrial size. This would fill in down here. But there would be so many more of these than there would be things here. Just this looks dense because that's the easiest thing to find. So there should be a lot of gas giants and a lot of Earth-like things. You just haven't found them yet. For lack of data. If you could correct this, that's the real trick here.
said that we don't have the like methods of finding planets that are like Earth right now. Are there any proposed methods that like just use technology that we don't have yet? Or
well, I mean,
it's not possible.
It's all about time that you observe, right? If you sit and watch long enough with a high precision enough camera, you'll find them as long as they're lined up. That's the main problem, is that they need to be in the plane of the orbit. So you're only finding one out of every 360 that you could have anyway. So that's not particularly helpful, right? But you can correct for that and talk about how common the Earth should be. But I think probably our best way forward is still transits, just to get a handle on, not sort of as a volume limited sample where you're not worrying about how bright the star is and stuff. You can piece together sort of how common a planet should be.
Since you have lots of data.
And then be able to correct for it and say, these are how many we think there are.
Yeah, just adjust.
Because at some point, without direct imaging, you're just not going to be able to tell. And that's basically at this stage impossible. If you've got a giant space telescope, you could maybe start to think about doing it. But so the new one that's supposed to launch this month, that will help with direct imaging, but still not going to be down to Earth. Here, is your hand up, or is that just the rest? Okay. So I wanted to sort of highlight. Here is one particular system. This is sort of the famous one. This is called TRAPPIST-1. I don't forget what TRAPPIST stands for. Something. Transiting something. This is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 roughly Earth-like planets in the same solar system, and what, rare? What, 3, 4 of them are on the habitable zone?
Three of them?
It's probably like these three. The orbital periods of these that are in the habitable zone, 4 days, 6 days, 9 days.
It's definitely EF, and then pick D or G.
Well, the artist's depiction of GD looks like it has oceans, so I pick D. So, and then look at the sort of, you know, planet radius, planet mass, planet density, right? Number E looks pretty good, doesn't it? Number E. Letter E. 93% Earth's gravity? Hey, I'll take it. Anything to keep these knees young. And then you can sort of see, right, compared to Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, right, these are all, you know, decently sized things, right? But look at those periods, distances to star. What kind of star, if those are in the habitable zone, D, E, and F, what kind of star is this?
It's like a white dwarf.
It's not a white dwarf. You would be you would be burnt to a crisp if you lived next to a white dwarf. You would be completely fucked. Sorry for my colorful language. It's a lot of x-rays, guys. It's not going to turn out well. You could see through your hand all the time.
Is that M-class?
M-class. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Yes. These are going to be the absolute coolest low-mass star you could possibly pick up. So a lot of red light. The sky is not going to look the same way that it does here, I can tell you that right now. Right? It's going to be like a very dim red star in your sky all the time.
Have you ever played Breath of the Wild? Right, the Blood Moon thing.
Yeah.
That's what your star would look like. Okay, not kind of creepy. Yeah. But otherwise, we're fine, right? It's gonna have liquid water. You can have, you know, photosynthesis. Plants won't be green, probably. Do you know why plants are green? We talked about this. Garrett? Yeah, so chlorophyll, right? That's the green pigment. The sun's peak wavelength, right, the part where it's brightest on its black body curve, is in the green part of the spectrum. And I don't think plants quite want all that light, so they reflect a little bit back with the green. It's kind of interesting. That's a total speculation. But, you know, if you have a different light distribution, you're going to have different chemistry in your plants that have you have a different color probably, right? You want to absorb light that you have. Sky's gonna be a different color. Albert?
Is there an actual picture, like basically impossible at this point?
To have an actual picture of one of these?
Yeah.
No. Absolutely not. These are all illustrations, right? But no, they're way too close to the star to take a direct image, and the resolution that you would need is, frankly, never going to happen. So, not on a 2021 budget anyway.
Have y'all seen Interstellar? The planet with the big tidal waves.
Yeah.
These are all so close to each other that apparently they might also have those huge tidal waves if they have liquid water.
Fun stuff.
Uh-huh.
So what we're saying is that if life exists in this habitable zone, it's going to look very different than it does here, right? It's going to have to swim really well, for one thing. David? How far away are these? I don't remember. You're on your phone, so. Right.
Is it likely that the system has some, like, gas tracks or something as well?
Right, so it very well may. Right, so this is just the first 0.06 AU.
Yeah.
That's not the ice line yet. So it's very possible that this has a gas giant. These are all transit discovered.
Okay.
So we just might not have gotten there yet.
The answer to that was 12 parsecs.
12 parsecs. That's actually pretty freaking close.
But they have an age here that's about 7.5 billion years old, so it's older than the solar system.
There you go.
Is it the sun, the star? Or
the star?
Why is there no A?
It starts with B.
Oh yeah, so this is the naming convention, is that planets always start with the lowercase letter B. Because A is the star. So TRAPPIST-1A refers to the star.
Yeah.
TRAPPIST-1 refers to the system.
What if it's binary?
What if it's binary?
Yeah, is it just like TRAPPIST-2? Do
they do some like Roman numerals or something?
No, the bigger the primary star would get capital A, secondary would get capital B, and then they would have to determine which star the planet orbits around. So if there was a planet orbiting around the primary, then it'd be planet capital A lowercase b, or capital B lowercase b.
But we also know about a planet that orbits two stars at the same time now. So it goes,
don't know what they do with that.
A circumbinary star? I would say they would just do B.
We have a trinary system.
Let's not go there. This is another thing that you have to correct for when you're trying to figure out how many planets there should be, right? Because binary systems, things work differently, right? All these are, except for a small handful of exceptions, are in single star systems. That we know about. So if you want to think about, right, 50% of stars are in binary systems, that's going to change your correction factors. And then higher order things, that gets messy real fast. Mark?
Let's say that they missed a planet between the sun and the first planet. Would they, like, change the letter every other planet?
They would have to, wouldn't they?
was a question.
If like, they found one that was at, say, one day, that should be B, do they come back and do they reorder them, or do they give it...
No, they would just...
They would call it I?
The next letter in the alphabet.
Yeah. So I guess it's an order of discovery if you discover them all at once. Well, you'd have to discover them from inside out. Because, right, because you have to, that's the shortest period, so you'd confirm that one first. Right?
But you can imagine how complex that light curve must look like with seven planets doing whatever they want with that light curve.
Just take a crayon and scribble.
Uh-huh.
Joanne?
So the artist depictions,
yeah.
Like, what are those based off of?
Total intuition. Usually I would say, like, they'd say, like, oh, we think it has an atmosphere based on X, Y, and Z evidence. Or we say, oh, this is in the habitable zone. So habitable zone planets can have liquid water. But this one's, like, right in the middle. This one's kind of further out, right? So this one has the most water. This one has the second most water. This one's getting locked up in ice a little bit, that sort of thing. It's just like, oh, if you take what we think we know about our solar system and apply it to this one, this is what it might look like. So these are saying, like, this is Venus, right? This is a particularly watery Earth. This is slightly less watery Earth, right? You know, that kind of thing. David?
What do we want to choose, like, if we were to theoretically, like, inhabit anywhere, what do we want to choose on with, like D as compared to F? I'm getting way off track, sorry.
It's okay. What was the question? I didn't quite.
I'm just thinking, like, wouldn't you want a planet with a smaller with a less strong gravity and density as compared to one that is, like, the difference between D and F out of the three?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think it depends on your preference.
There's a lot of factors, but I mean... Like,
right? I mean, I think the general idea is you want it as close to 1G as you can have it, so that things behave the way they do here.
But you could also launch stuff off
it. Sure. I mean, it's easier to launch things off the moon, right? That's why they want to build, like, a moon base to do stuff with in the future, right? But... I mean, don't get me wrong, it would be really nice to weigh half as much.
Right.
Right? You can get around a lot better. But, Garrett? Mind blown. The thoughts have just left. Well, this is, you said 12 parsecs? This is 26 light years away. So that's 26 years at light speed, which is not going to happen, right? This would take thousands of years to get to. We can talk to them in our lifetime if they were, you know, but...
It was like a generational shift, and we have some way of, like, artificial gravity, like, that we did, like...
Yes. So it's interstellar again, right? Garrett, when you invent warp drive, come back and let me know.
I'll be the
All right, I will see you all on Wednesday.